This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. On May 29th, Beth Sullivan reported in the Austin Chronicle that a sizable group of parents and advocates, calling themselves the AISD Equity Coalition, sent a letter to the AISD Board of Trustees calling for better community engagement and transparency in the search for a new superintendent. The letter recommends that AISD open all meetings to the public and reach out to each campus community. Roxanne Evans, a member of the East Austin Coalition for Quality Education, commented, "Community engagement in the attempt to hire a new superintendent isn't a couple of Zoom meetings in English." A few weeks later, Valerie Stern at the UT Institute for Urban Policy Research and Analysis published a report that examined school poverty disparities throughout the state of Texas. She and her colleagues found that schools in Travis County were more segregated than anywhere else in the state. Data showed that students who live in poverty are concentrated at some of the schools, and those schools are the ones where Black and Latino students are found. In a June 17th opinion piece in the Austin American Statesman, Stern observes, "The events of 2020 have brought into focus the sharp inequities in our society. The racism that we see playing out in our city and nation is not the result of a few bad actors, but a system in which we are all complicit." The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on June 15th. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Dr. Stephanie Hawley. Stephanie is the first ever Chief Equity Officer for the Austin Independent School District. She's been a guest on the program before, and we welcome her back tonight. We also have Jim Harrington, founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Michelle Manning Scott is back with us again, too. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for joining us, Stephanie. How you been?
I've been fine. It's been, I don't know, probably the most, like most people on the planet right now, we've never seen anything like this. And I have a lot of hope. I have a lot of hope that's emerging from all of this. When I say I'm fine, that's fine with a really tiny F, tiny, tiny F. But I'm working on just looking for the hope in this situation.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. We'll get into a lot of these details as we go along here, but it certainly has been a kind of a double whammy between the pandemic and protests the past few weeks. Anyway, when you were last on here, it was this past October, you were fairly new on the job. I think you had been hired for all of about a month when the school closures had been announced. And the original batch, if I recall, was somewhere near a dozen, and they wound up closing four of them, actually, in November. But we talked to you just as the announcement had been made, and there were town hall meetings being held. So just to kind of wind forward from there, I think the next major event was in November. I think, if I recall right, it was around November 18th, and it was a meeting of the school board. You were quoted on the news quite a bit that night. Do you want to remind us what all happened at that school board meeting?
Yeah, well, not really, but I will. yeah, it was, and I tell anybody, this is a privilege to be in this space at this time. But I was basically asked to come forward and give my thoughts about the proposal that was being offered up for the board to vote on. And I had spent about probably from about mid-September to that date talking to various decision makers and staff about what this plan, this proposal was going to do to Black, Brown, and poor people in Austin. And so what I said that night was not a secret. There wasn't a single person in the district. There wasn't a single person that I worked with or that was on that dais that did not know what my analysis was. And so, you know, some people feigned surprise and shock, but I had written analyses. I had been in meetings. I had talked with folks. So it was not a secret.
Yeah.
But it was when, and I often tell people, equity office and ethics, equity and ethics go together. And it's really difficult. I did not think I would be in that situation of having to share my analysis that I'd been sharing individually and at small group meetings. And so it was very difficult to actually just put it out there in plain daylight in that way.
Sure. And then a few weeks later, you actually followed that up with a report. I didn't read the whole thing, but I remember reading the summary and a little bit of the kind of browse through the report, but it was pretty hard hitting. And I'm just curious what kind of a response you got from AISD and from the public from that report that you issued in December.
Well, the report was actually written before the vote, and it got stuck in a kind of a cul-de-sac of being edited and reviewed and that kind of thing. And everything that was in that report, the instruments that were used to analyze the process, right? Mm-hmm. It had all been taught to the staff and the folks that actually wrote the proposal. So I didn't use any instruments or analysis to which people had not been exposed. I did what they called emergency. There's no such thing, by the way, but it's what we called an emergency equity training. because when I saw what was being proposed, I asked, could I have, and I spent probably a little over 32 hours in total teaching and conducting workshops and professional learning for senior leaders, the extended cabinet. And I shared with them all of the instruments that I used for the analysis. I did not think it was fair to evaluate the process with, you know, tools and approaches that they hadn't been exposed to. So they had been exposed to everything that was in that report. There's a piece in that report about an analysis for looking at white supremacy culture in your process and decision making. I taught that to more than 100 people, and I taught them how to recognize it when they, not just school closures, but with everything that we do, to actually look at it and see, are we engaged in this erasing of other people's cultures and identities and power? And so people had been exposed, and I did more than 32 hours of workshops, because even in real time in meetings, I say all that to say, again, that report was not, it may have been shocking maybe for the public, but internally people had been exposed to all of that information before the vote. And, you know, internally people weren't happy. They saw that report before the vote, and some people actually contributed to it, and some of my colleagues were excited, and actually, I have the email trail for it. My colleagues were like, wow, we've never done anything like this, and we don't know what part of this is not true. So it wasn't like I was exposing something that just wasn't true or inaccurate. I invited them to critique what I'd done and tell me, because I know that I'm new. You don't know everything that you think you know when you come into this situation. So people who had been working in the district for a long time, I asked them to critique that report.
You know, Stephanie, I think since We probably have some listeners that weren't on the first time. It might be helpful if you gave a short overview of the report.
Okay, so the report basically was developed before, it was developed during the process, the school closures proposal, what we were calling school changes. But the report was to actually analyze, at its root, was about what will be the impact on Black, Brown, and poor communities on school closures. How will it disrupt the communities that surround the schools, and how will it disrupt the lives of the children that are in the schools? And so looking at the data, looking at the students who are in the schools, and also taking into account what was heard in those communities. We had a lot of community engagement, what we call community engagement circles. And I also took that information into account. But the idea behind the report was to help people understand what the damage would be to children closing their schools and to communities. And then most importantly, you know, what is needed by leadership so that we make decisions that are, well, in effect, anti-racist. I don't know, Jim, if I gave enough context there. But the idea behind the report was for people to take a step back and do a deep analysis of what these proposed closures were going to do to real lives and real people.
And I think your report was pretty clear that we've continued the segregation patterns.
Absolutely.
Historically.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the thing about the report, and the report, we didn't go into a deep analysis on it, but the guiding principles for the school, what was called school changes, the guiding principles were flawed, and they were designed, you know, they were perfectly, those principles got us exactly where we were. So for me, and I had said this at a previous board meeting, at my actually my first time talking to the board in, I believe, September, I told them that the guiding principles were flawed. So if your guiding principles are flawed, and they weren't designed for desegregation, those guiding principles were, that wasn't the end game for them. And I had said that publicly, that the problem with the guiding principles were they were going to lead us to a place that was not good. And it was counter to what we say our values are in the district in terms of being inclusive and being anti-racist and taking care of the most marginalized students. So desegregation was never a part of the guiding principles.
You know, I can well imagine that at AISD right now that there must be a fair amount of internal dismay over just the pandemic, if nothing else. You know, I've talked to some of the people I worked with up there at Navarro High School, and it sounds like they're still trying to figure out how to even get the schools open again this fall. But having said that, where do things stand with the rest of the closures at this point? I mean, is that all kind of on hold pending getting the schools open, or is there some process that has continued to advance regarding closing more schools?
Well, at this point, the four schools that were slated to close, Pease Brook and Norman, the bringing Sims. Together of Norman Sims
right.
communities, those are, you know, those are a done deal. There's not been any conversation and focus that I've been a part of to talk about the rest of the process. Most of our energy, and I've been on at least four calls today, and that's what we've been focused on, is how do we safely reopen schools at this point. I've been very involved at the outset and actually got to do a seminar and a presentation on what it looks like to open the schools with a true racial equity and inclusive focus. And so I'm on the core team. And so unlike school changes, I was in on the ground floor and am on a couple of task forces and subcommittees as well. And I have a staff member or two that are on a couple of the subcommittees as well. But yeah, our focus over the last five, six, probably longer than that, has been how do we safely open schools and in an equitable way, and looking at our most vulnerable populations and looking at the zip codes where coronavirus is doing its most damage to which populations. And so, and then we're doing a lot of community engagement meetings and hearing from families about under what conditions would they come back to school, and, you know, do they ever plan to come back to school? You know, we've talked to families about you know, what's their thinking? Because we've got a lot of families that need their kids to be back in school because they're essential workers. And so looking at TEA guidelines and, you know, the state. So daily we're on these calls talking about what does the return look like? And we're working closely with our principals because we know that we can't come up with a blueprint that fits 128, well, like 124 schools. We cannot come up with a blueprint that's going to work for every single school, but we do want all of our principals and people to be focused on the most vulnerable populations in their building at this point.
Sure, sure. I know when they were closed back in March, and I think it almost seems like it came as a surprise that a lot of the kids, you know, especially from the poorer households, did not have internet access and and didn't have computer access. I remember up at Navarro, they were handing out one afternoon, they were just handing out computers. People, it caused a traffic jam in front of the school, you know?
Yeah, there's, I mean, we handed out tens of thousands of computers, Chromebooks.
Yeah.
And yeah, we were also aware that there were no hotspots, Wi-Fi access for students. And so we went into an emergency stage of distribution. And then we still have children that didn't have devices. And so we passed out packets. And then, you know, then there's the whole conversation about, is it appropriate for pre-K through second graders to be on devices? And so we, at one point, at places where we distributed meals, and we distributed meals to anybody. We didn't ask for ID. So there were, we know that there were people that came and got meals that were, you know, were not a part of the district, but because of the emergency state of things. So we were distributing meals and we also distributed packets. And then we also mailed packets, thousands of packets to students whom we didn't hear from, but had their addresses, because it became dangerous, quite frankly, for people to come and pick up packets, and we were trying to reduce contact, so we wound up mailing things. So there was a lot of, we really went into full-on emergency mode trying to get students what they needed for learning during the last part of the semester.
Yeah.
Stephanie, it's Michelle. I was just curious, since you mentioned that about the number of students that you guys were serving, and was wondering if there's any information yet from the district on like how many students actually fell off your guys' radar that basically you didn't hear from after things started falling apart and basically got lost.
Yeah, so that's shuffle. Been our ongoing piece, the contacts we had, and it's right around, it's a little over 95% of our students that we were able to make contact with at some level. So we have not finished that report, but it is well over 95%. The principals and the teachers were primary in terms of contacting families. And that was heavy lifting. That was extreme heavy lifting. And for the equity office, for our office, there are only three of us in the equity office at this point, but we fielded calls and emails from people who, for whatever reason, weren't able to make contact with their principals or their schools. And so it was an all-out, all-hands-on-deck effort to find as many of our students as we could find. We didn't find 100% of our students, but it was an all-out effort to get in contact with as many as possible.
Another thing I wonder if you're looking at, or this district is looking at in terms of minority kids, Seaside kids, the educational gap that's going to happen, obviously, exacerbate the gap that's already there.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, we are looking at standards in too many districts, and ours as well. You know, the STAR exam, the standardized test, was the measure of everything. And right now we're turning to a couple of things that we've been trying to shift towards, I've been told. We're being more direct about the need for standards-based curriculum. The whole idea that the test, the STAR exam, is not the measure of cognitive development and learning that goes on through the year. And so as part of the reopening process, we're looking at, okay, what is it a kid in fourth grade needs to know? And how are we going to do this personalized learning? And how is the technology going to augment this? Because we all believe and know, based on what we've seen, is that we're probably going to be sheltering again at home in, you know, if things open up, right? We have a start date of August 18th, but we've started talking about what does that look like? And many of us are against the remediation model because remediation does not work when students were already struggling under the old abnormal, right? We know that model wasn't even working then. And so now we have to look at how do we meet students where they are? And then how do we come at it from a strengths-based approach to try to accelerate based on their strengths instead of looking and saying they're broken and they're going to have to repeat the same material over and over again. And I think one of the most important things a district did was to not go with grades. We knew that a grade wasn't going to tell us much about a student's academic performance during the pandemic crisis. And so we went with incompletes, right, and with passes so that students weren't penalized with an A, B, or C grade. We knew that if we gave grades, all that was going to tell us is who had access to the tech devices and who had access to support and families who could help them navigate online learning. And so we went with the incomplete and with a pass. And so whenever we return to the buildings, we'll be able to see which students are incomplete. And then we've got to meet those students where they are to try to move them forward in the grade levels that they're moving into. And we can never reclaim the time that we lost with them.
I think what bothers me is, I like your ideas for sure, but you're going to have the West Side students whose parents could spend a lot of time with them and had the educational skills to guide them. You're going to have the East Side parents who had to get out to work. Right. And have understood English to start with, you know, and the gap is going to be pretty significant.
For me, Jim, I've talked to folks about this for years. We got to get beyond the gap talk, because the gap, what is the gap? The gap is where Black and Brown, the system helps Black and Brown children and low-income children. And the top of that gap, right? The crest of that gap is allegedly white middle-class children. And so what we do is we don't look at the strengths. We don't look at anything with the Black children and the Brown children, low-income children. We just have them chasing this gap, this line. And when I sometimes tell people, I say, you know, if the white children are the standard. Their performance is the standard. And they are the children for whom the system was built. And so that would make sense that they would perform well in a system that was built for them. And I said, if we could get to the point where we want high achievement for all the students, and if we can get to the point where a standardized test, again, that was built for middle-class white children, vocabulary test and everything for middle class, if we can get away from this system that was built for their performance, and we get to the point where we really understand what is it that students need to be successful. And then we want high achievement for all of those students. We don't want them just chasing in a test that's going to change anyway. You know, we've been through tax and you name them. All the acronyms we've been through in the last over 20 years. And all of those tests produce the same results. And the system produces the same results. So the system produces the gaps. And so now taking a step back and saying, where do we want those kids to get to? If there is no STAR exam, which there wasn't this year, how would we know learning is taking place? And then how do we prove it and how do we document it? That's the hard work we're having to do as educators. And then looking at what is culturally relevant and culturally proficient instruction look like? All of those things, factors that we have a chance to step back and do it well. And that's what two-thirds of my meetings are about every day for the last 3 months.
Do you think the district is going to make that kind of commitment of resource?
Well, for one thing, we're going to be part of this conversation is that how do we better leverage the resources we have? The other thing is the state has cut funding, right? They've cut it and they're going to cut it again. And so we can either say, woe is us, or either we can look around and say, what resources do we have and in what ways do we need to better leverage them? So those of us who are pushing equity in particular, we're saying, are we putting the best, most experienced teachers in our Title I schools? And if so, prove it, right? Where are the receipts, as I often say? With the programs that we're using, literacy programs, whatever programs we're using, where is the evidence that is benefiting Black, Brown children that we fail? And there's no evidence that these programs have any efficacy, then we've got those dollars need to be reallocated for something else. So we're having to take a hard look at budgets, and then we're having to look at what has actually produced any results over time. What curricula, what programs? Well, we've got to look at the internal resources that we have and say, in what ways are we not using these resources? We've got some amazing teachers in the district, and I think you know that. But are they in the right schools? Are they in the places where the need is the greatest? Because you said earlier, you know, the West Side kids, their parents, some of them probably went on open source and they were probably doing coursework, you know, college coursework, because it wasn't working. Clearly, it wasn't working before the pandemic. And so now that everything is in flux, because we're looking at part of whatever we deliver is going to be online. There's no way around that. The technology is not going to play a role in the delivery of instruction forever at this point. But to what degree do we use the current resources? So I don't know if I answered your question, Jim, but the district, we can't do what we've always done. We can't return to the old abnormal. And it's going to mean that we look at the current resources to make those changes.
The superintendent search, are you involved in that? Are they going to bring you into that process?
I've been on one phone call with 25 other administrators to say what I think what are the attributes of the next superintendent. And that's been the limit of my participation. And no one has signaled to me whether I would be involved at any other levels at this point. So that is the limitation of my involvement at this point. But we had a good, robust conversation with the consultant about, you know, just not even, I mean, we talked about the technical skills, but we also talked about, you know, character and, you know, and making sure we bring somebody in with evidence that they know how to do this work around racial equity and what I call social justice and education work, because that will set us back 100 years to bring somebody in who will be opposed or passive aggressive in their support for this agenda to do some really hard work. So, but that's been the limitation of my involvement in the process at this point.
We're speaking with Dr. Stephanie Hawley, Chief Equity Officer for the Austin Independent School District. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on June 15th. We're speaking with Dr. Stephanie Hawley, Chief Equity Officer for the Austin Independent School District. Go ahead, Michelle, did you have something?
Oh, I was just going to follow up on, well, one question was, have you heard any kind of revolutionary talk going on, given that we've got this ongoing pandemic and the possibility of distance learning is going to be continuing, and the fact that we've been relying on technology at this point to a large extent, and I just think there's a lot of ideas that could come out of that as far as, you know, hopefully somewhat leveling the playing field, because you're talking about having teachers in schools that you see as being more valuable in other schools at this point. And that just begs the question, well, couldn't they be provided electronically, so to speak, in other schools?
Yeah, so that's part of the work that we're doing around reopening. We've got four scenarios that we've been working with and looking at You know, what does it mean to bring part of the students in every day? We would never have a full school, of course, but we would bring students in cohorts and in groups. And we looked at having master, the teachers that are what we call master teachers in some ways that have the experience and have a track record for being able to support students with rigorous instruction and having those teachers to team up. And so principals, again, are making some decisions about what this actually looked like. In 124 different schools of special education, right? Like Dawson Elementary. And we have schools that have different populations and different populations with different strengths and different needs. And so the principals are going to be using a lot of the guidelines that we are developing in central office. But we also know there's going to be a time when there may be a couple of corona cases in one school. And then that school is going to need to shut down and roll on to online learning. And maybe other schools, they have no COVID cases. So they may be moving along at the same pace. And so these are all the scenarios that are coming up. But we are looking at the quality, because this does give us the opportunity, and our academics area is now taking that step back to say, how do we make sure everybody's got rigorous instruction? And how do we make sure the students that need the best teachers are getting the best teaching? This virus has just thrown so much light on everything. And so we're working at this point at trying to figure out how do we get the best teachers in front of the students with the greatest needs for rigorous instruction. Sometimes people think our students in Title I schools aren't capable, right? And poverty and intelligence, there's no connection there. We've got children in poverty who are amazing and gifted. And we need teachers working with our students who are in poverty so that they can elevate those gifts and don't come in with deficit thinking. So, you know, back to your question, this is our opportunity. And right now, everybody seems to be very much on board with this shift and this reconfiguration that's going to happen. Otherwise, we will have done double damage to our students.
If we could shift perspective just a little bit here, thinking about the past few weeks, there have been almost continuous protests, mostly focused on police behavior. But the larger picture, of course, is inequity across races and ethnic groups in the city and the cities of the U.S. I'm just curious, what are the implications for AISD? You know, as you watch all this unfold, I'm guessing that you're not totally surprised by it all. And do you think much about how this extends to your own position?
So let me see if I understand your question. You're wanting to understand about the police brutality piece? Phrase your question for me.
Yeah, not so much the police brutality, but the underlying motivation for these protests, it seems to me, goes beyond the immediate police behavior, where we've got whole communities that are being treated badly. And by extension, is there an analogy for AISD in all this?
Oh, absolutely. Because what you're really looking at is, I mean, globally, of course, everybody is outraged, and you know, you just have this global uprising because folks really don't like to name what we're really looking at, but what we're really looking at is anti-blackness. We're looking at anti-blackness in New Zealand, Australia, England, name a country where uprising is going on. And there's anti-blackness in our schools. You can look at it when you see who's in ISS and who's in the gifted and talented program. And so there are implications because schools are the pipeline to prison. When we get pre-K kids getting kicked out of class, and of course, I think last time I was on, I talked a little bit about, you know, how we changed the policy a few years ago. However, we still have disproportionate numbers of Black and brown children in school suspension. And so the implications for the training that needs to take place, policy, our office has been working on policy to support the board in actually writing racial equity policy. Because without policy, you're going to continue with unexamined anti-blackness. Because if you would talk to a single teacher who kicks the same children out, we can predict what color their skin is every day. You go, what's wrong with this kid? We got to, you know, get a program for him. And then I'm looking at going, you are looking at your data and you're looking at the same people year after year who seem to have a problem with the same children with the same level of melanin in their skin. So you can keep creating programs, and then our children wind up in Garner Betts. They wind up incarcerated as youth. And so we have to take a step back now that, I mean, it's just the full sunlight is on everything. In what ways is anti-Blackness at work within the school district?
Right, right.
And then how do we know it? We have to look at the data, and the data tell us. The data are all over the place. I mean, you would have to, you can't pretend that it's not at work. But the problem is people get confused with individual racism. I'm not a racist. I've never said the N-word, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, you don't understand. You're cooperating and participating in a system that has valued certain lives and certain experiences and certain skin color over others. And you're doing it automatically. You're complicit. And Black and brown people are complicit in the system. So it's not like, oh, this is just the white people are doing this. Black and brown teachers are doing the same thing. And so now the district has come to a place, and Dr. Angela Ward, who's over cultural proficiency and inclusiveness, we are working on what does it look like, what it looks like, is we just keep doing the same thing and keep blaming the children in their communities. And so this whole thing has implications for education all day long. We have to stop hiring people that have never worked with Black children, for God's sake. Yeah. You can't teach children you don't know. And we keep bringing in our Title I schools, we have way too many teachers that are straight out of school, straight out of college, and they think because they're nice to the children that that's cultural proficiency. And so as a system, we fail those teachers and we fail the children. So yeah, all of this has got to, it's all, there's a reckoning. What can I say, Bob?
There's a reckoning. Sure. Well, and then just one last question about the protests and whatnot. You know, I did mention that the police, AISD has its own police force. It's a branch of APD. Has there been any talk of that discontinuing or any modifications to the AISD police force?
Not yet. And our police department is not a branch of APD. We have our own Chief Ashley Gonzalez. But interestingly enough, I'm in a conversation tomorrow to talk about a community conversation with our police. I just served on the promotion panel for our police a couple of weeks ago. And so this conversation just gotten started. But we've talked about the presence of people with guns and badges in the school. And many people have talked over the years about why don't we have more counselors than, and you know, we give police cute names. And I call it cute names that we call school resource officers. Mm-hmm. And I know many of them, and they're amazing human beings, and they're lovely people. But as a system, we have to start to ask our question, why do we have more of these school resource officers than we have counselors in the building?
Yeah,
that's the real conversation that has to be had. And I'm not sure that's the conversation because I didn't call that meeting. But I have a meeting tomorrow to talk about how do we talk with the community. And our police officers had just started anti-racist training with me in January, and we're scheduled to do something in March when the pandemic showed up. But we had our office pushed that the police need to be involved over a couple of years in every other month training to look at their data and then to develop their lens for, and you know, everybody talks about anti-bias training or implicit bias training. And I don't like those words. They're too cute for the deadly force of what implicit bias is to Black and brown children. When people have unchecked implicit bias, well, you can see what happens when people have unchecked implicit bias. It could mean your death.
Yeah.
And so we talk to people explicitly about anti-racist and getting people to be able to say race, racist, anti-racist, and Black. You know, people are struggling. Being able to even say the word Black is pretty interesting. That adjective has been interesting. So yeah, we've got deep work to do, and I'm excited to be invited to tomorrow's meeting to find out, you know, where are we going first?
Hmm. Well, good luck with that one. Well, we're we're running out of time here, and this Friday is Juneteenth. And I'm just wondering if you had any reflections about that.
Yeah. So yeah, I grew up in my dad was in the Air Force. So we moved around a lot. My dad's from Louisiana. My mother's from East Texas. And as a kid, I just always thought Juneteenth was a Texas thing. But it was never a celebration in my home. It was always a day of mourning and commemoration and reflection. My dad, who was an enlisted man, you know, he never thought there was anything great about having thousands of people work 2.5 years more than they should have.
Yeah.
And nobody was ever given reparations or wages for illegal labor of enslaved Africans, right?
Yeah.
And my dad never called people slaves. He said they were enslaved.
Yeah.
And he used to say that the people who enslaved Africans were enslavers. So for me, it has always been, and even my biological adult children, Juneteenth has never been the celebration that it is for many people. I do honor and respect the celebration that people feel about that. Don't get me wrong. I have no problem with it. But for me, on a personal note, it's a deep warning about what this country has been doing for a long time. And the fact that nobody said, we need to pay these people 2.5 years beyond their emancipation. So it's reflective. And then, you know, and then making sure children and families and communities actually know the story about Juneteenth, right? Yeah. Because there are a lot of Black, white folks everywhere. I understand there's a celebration in Mexico.
Yeah.
For Juneteenth. I just learned that today. So my prayer is that we become educated about the patterns of this country so they can be disrupted. Because if you don't recognize the repeated patterns, we will keep rebuilding systems. And that's the only opportunity I see with this virus and this pandemic right now. It is an opportunity because all the systems basically have been shattered. And we have the opportunity to build something new or try to glue back together the pieces of something that never worked anyway.
Yeah.
Not for Black and brown children. So yeah, Juneteenth is that reflective time.
Sure. Well, Jim or Michelle, do you have anything else to add?
No, thanks, Stephanie. It's been a really good conversation, putting a lot of stuff in focus in it. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing. You have your work cut out for you and you're doing a good job taking advantage of all the opportunities that present themselves. So grateful for that.
Well, I'm grateful for you all. It's always beautiful to know that all the folks on this call are, you're paying attention, you're present, and you're conscious. And that gives us incredible hope when our community is sitting up straight and you feel like you're never alone. So thank you all for what you do.
Well, wish you much luck, steam, and hope for the future for AISD and this journey that we're now hopefully all being guided on.
Yeah,
absolutely. Just know there's a critical mass of people that are doing this work. So I'm not by myself. We have an internal growing group of people who are becoming conscious and feeling less powerless, right? As people find their power. I always tell them, I can't empower you, but I can help you find your power so that you can speak when you need to. So just want let you all know it's a collective. An internal and external collective that helps this work move.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening and hope to get you back again soon. A few brief updates since speaking with Dr. Hawley several weeks ago. On the question of reopening the schools, as of Friday, July 10th, AISD has issued a statement on its website. Austin ISD has planned extensively for reopening schools on August 18th with guidance from state and local authorities and health officials, working to ensure that health and safety procedures are in place. We've been using what we learned from our students, staff, and families to create a hybrid learning model that includes in-person and virtual learning for the fall. Our families want choice for in-person and virtual learning. This model is designed to support the health and safety of our staff and community and the learning needs of our 81,000 students and their families. We are eager for additional guidance from the Texas Education Agency. End of quote from the AISD website. However, Education Austin, the largest union of AISD certified and classified employees, has taken the following stance. From their website, "Put health and safety first. We need to stop the return of on-campus learning until public health data shows it is safe for students, families, teachers, and school employees. Opening schools for on-campus learning in the current environment would put too many people's safety at risk. AISD needs to respect the health of our students, families, teachers, and school employees. We call on AISD to hold all lessons virtually for the first 9 weeks of the school year. AISD needs to use public health data to determine when it is truly safe to reopen the schools. AISD needs to stop the plan to reopen on August 18th. This story is still developing. Here is an approximate poetic translation. Now they are eliminating the doves, and freedom they are counting her days. I don't want to imagine what's on the horizon. Mama, more than ever, I need you. I didn't want to sadden you because I love you. To give you good news is what I would prefer. The more the world hurts, the more I yearn for you, Mother. More than ever, I require your company. Take my hand. Give me the security to see, like one who has just been born. The innocence, the longing, the miracle of being, the tenderness, the freshness of the earth at the time of the rain, the firmness, the beauty of the guama tree at the time of flowering. Mother, tell me who will redeem what was lost. Faithful and tenacious mother, defeat the voracious hatred in honor of the dead. I assure you the truth will win. Those who are awake will never forget. For life, for life, for life and peace." This was dedicated for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and all precious Black lives brutally murdered by police and 401 years of systemic racism. For all our ancestors and for the children, ni un paso atrás, not one step back. A quick note from the Community Council at KOOP. We want to know how you're faring through the COVID-19 crisis. If you have questions about community resources, or if you'd just like to share a story about people doing good work, you can leave us a message by emailing covid19@coop.org. Or you can call or text 512-710-5353. A member of our community council will get back to you. That's COVID19@coop.org or 512-710-5353 for Co-op's COVID-19 Community Response Line. Well, that's all for this evening. Thanks again to Dr. Stephanie Hawley and to our regular guest, Jim Harrington, and for production assistance from Michelle Manning Scott. Our theme music is by an artist who goes by the name Komiku, and the selection is entitled Fuli Lorison. Stay tuned for theme music coming up next. Have a good evening, everyone, and stay safe. Thank you.